Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Before the Fall is Juliet West's first novel, set in London's East End dockyard area during the First World War, inspired by a true story. Juliet was a journalist and then did an MA in creative writing. Hi, Juliet. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So your novel is interesting as it's not your typical World War I book at all. It's not a romance of an officer with a middle-class kind of background. Instead, this is set in a working-class area with working-class characters and involves feminist patriots and pacifists. We'll talk about them later, but first of all, it started with a newspaper clipping. Where did you find it?
Yeah, actually, it was back in early 1997, and I was working, just doing casual shifts at the Daily Mail, and I was asked to work on a story that the features desk were writing, and it was this tragic love affair which had happened 1916 to 1918. And the documents relating to the case had just been made public at the National Archives in Kew. And so the Mail was writing a feature on it. And I was asked to try and trace any living relatives of the woman involved and her lover. So that was my initial involvement. And it just, the story really haunted me for years and years. And eventually I decided to try and fictionalise it.
RadioGorgeous.com. So did you find any living characters?
Yes, I did. By going through sort of birth, death, marriage certificates, I found the granddaughter of Annie Baker, which is the real name of the woman involved, and also the grandson of Richard Luck, who was her lover.
I see. So you have changed the names. Is that so you just don't get into any trouble, or just why did you do that?
Yeah, it was something that I wrestled with, really, because initially I wanted to use the real names, and legally there was no bar to that. The names were there in the public eye at the time because there was a court case surrounding this story. The names are there in the public records at Kew, but I just felt ethically slightly uncomfortable with it. And I felt ultimately if I fictionalised the story, changed the names, then I had a bit more freedom to create a sort of wider world, perhaps make the characters more complex and sometimes perhaps a bit darker. So that was why I made the decision, and I felt so much freer once I had, actually.
The novel set in the East End and the docks now, which have been completely gentrified. I mean, they don't exist. They were broken up in the 50s. How did you manage with the geography of it all?
Yeah, that was a huge part of it, actually. Trying to recreate what that area was like 100 years ago, because as you say, it was devastated in the Second World War in the Blitz. Well, there was some bombing in the First World War, but you know, compared to the Second World War, that areas were flattened. And then, of course, the 50s and 60s and 80s, there was so much redevelopment then. So the way to do it, firstly, old maps. Don't think I ever started a writing day without having a look at the maps and just trying to really recreate the geography. But I also went to the areas, of course, several times and walked the streets. There are pockets that remain. You know, some of that old architecture is there around Poplar and Canning Town. And there's a bridge that features in the book. And the bridge is demolished, but there's some of the red brick piers are still there, sort of covered in graffiti. And so there's elements that you can still see. And so I would walk those routes and just try and build up the picture that way.
Because you talk about creeks. And I remember when I'd been down the river, someone pointed them out to me. It's like little kind of causeways down to the river. They're used quite a lot in your book.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Bow Creek, which for me, when I initially sort of hear the word creek, I think of a little gentle river in America. I don't think of London. But actually, when you see Bow Creek, it's a vast sort of waterway, tidal and integral to the shipping at the time. And so, of course, if you lived in Canning Town, as my main character does, you had to cross the creek to get to, you know, Poplar and sort of the main areas of London. And then again, to go down to Millwall Dock, which is where she worked, there were more dock bridges to cross. And, you know, the area is just defined by those waterways and the bridges, I think.
So there's factories in it. Did the factories... And there's a cafe in it. Did they exist?
Yeah, they existed. Absolutely, oh, wow. Yes. The munitions factory where Hannah in the book... So Hannah has a best friend, Dor, who works at a munitions factory at Silvertown. That there was an explosion there, a massive explosion in 1917. Apparently it was felt sort of in Essex and, you know, windows were blown out all over London. It was a huge explosion. So that absolutely was real. The cafe where Hannah worked was real, next to Millwall Dock. So yeah, all those places existed. And when you asked earlier about how I tried to sort of build up the picture, I don't think I mentioned photographs. I mean, there are archives of photographs that you can find in various museums and brilliant Docklands Museum. There's the Island History Trust. There's a local history library in Mile End, and you can see the photos. So yeah.
So you did a lot of research.
I did. But it was, and actually it's strange because I delayed writing this novel because I thought, oh, historical fiction, that's going to be really hard. But actually the research ended up being just the joy of it. I loved doing the research, and it was more tear myself away from that to do the writing than the other way around, which surprised me actually.
Interesting. Now, how did you get in the heads of quite... simple people in the East End 100 years ago? I mean, they are so different than us, aren't they? I mean, not emotionally, but as in, you know, their outlooks, their morals.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a real challenge because, of course, with the First World War, there's so much written about the military campaigns and the soldiers, but far less about the ordinary men and women living at that time. I think it was mainly through physical books, actually. So I would find in these archives... There was one in particular called Maternity, and it was published in 1915. And it's letters from working women about their experiences of childbirth and motherhood. It is hair-raising. I mean, you just can't believe the stories that these people are telling. And the ignorance was astonishing. There was one woman who was married at 28 and she was 8 months pregnant. And she said, I had no idea how or where this child was going to come into the world. My mum had told me nothing. You know, the levels of ignorance and poverty, you know, these women that wrote the letters weren't the poorest. You know, they were literate,
yeah,
working women.
Right.
And yet, within 2 months of a birth, they were standing back at their sinks doing the laundry, working on laundry that they had jobs at home, sort of finishing shirts, or, you know, they couldn't afford to take time off from their jobs. So these voices from 1915 were there. I mean, it's a whole book of 100-odd letters. So that was an amazing book. Very much through that first-hand recollection, oral history, I guess.
Also to get the language, to get the characters, to get the, you know, the clothes. And I love the description of the currant bun. That really, you know, it just, I could smell it, I could taste it.
Great. You know, I think with the language, I should say as well that my family are, my mum and dad are both originally from London, sort of working-class Londoners. And sometimes I could hear like my great aunts who would have been born around that time and my grandparents. So the voice, just some of the sort of little sayings were there from my own family. And they weren't EastEnders, they were South London. So I could add that in as well, hopefully.
My weekday fix, darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous. Can you tell us about these feminist patriots and their feathers?
An interesting phenomenon at the start of the war that... huge government propaganda campaign because they knew that the regular army was not going to be enough. They needed hundreds of thousands of volunteers. Women were sort of targeted to help men to enlist, really. Yeah. You know, there were posters that were, "Women of Britain say go. Is your best boy in khaki? If he isn't, shouldn't he be?" You know, this is the kind of message that women were being given. And some of them, I'm sure, didn't agree with that, but many sort of took this up with fervour. And there was actually a organisation called the White Feather Brigade, and mainly targeting women, and they would go around with white feathers, and if they saw a man in civilian clothing, they'd give him a white feather. And it wasn't always done very politely. You know, I read accounts of men having one stuffed up their nose on a bus. You know, it was just astonishing. And trying to shame these men who may not have enlisted for really good reasons. You know, they might be deaf, or they might, you know, there were very good reasons that men didn't enlist. It wasn't necessarily cowardice, but they were shamed. And for some men, I think that had an impact, and they did go and join up.
So that's the kind of root of the book. She falls in love with a man who is...
It was called a starred occupation or a protected occupation. Mm. And this would be men whose work was almost seen as war work. So, for instance, Richard Luck, who Annie fell in love with, was a ship repairer at Millwall Dock. And obviously ships were being torpedoed all the time, and that was vital to get those ships back out to sea. So his job would have been protected. Having said that, no man had a kind of unlimited exemption. They had to go before tribunals, and you would normally get maximum 6 months, and then that would be reviewed. And as the war went on, they wouldn't always get their exemption renewed.
I suppose also they'd be looking at, if they were a young man, they'd say, you've got to go. Whereas the older man, I mean, like, I know my grandpa in the Second World War, he had a reserved occupation, but he was probably quite old by then.
I think at the start of conscription, I think it was up to 35, and then gradually the age, you know, my great grandfather in the end, I think he did actually volunteer, but he was 41, you know.
What? A 41 year old going to war?
But he was a driver, actually, my great grandfather. He wasn't on the front line. But yeah, so for older men, there were different jobs. Yes. Not everyone had to be in the trench.
Yes.
But no, huge and unimaginable pressures. You know, it just, I think that's what fascinated me about it, is that I just can't imagine being in that society, living in that world.
And can you tell us about pacifists? Because again, the conches, they're kept quiet, aren't they? If you refused to go, were you sent to prison?
Yeah, I think there were different levels of conscientious objection. So you could be an absolutist, and that's where you absolutely refuse to have anything to do with the war. And yes, you would be imprisoned, or, I mean, what I've read, there's conflicting accounts of what happened to those people. I think some were, their objections weren't allowed and they were sent anyway. Or you could say you didn't want to bear arms, but perhaps you'd be a stretcher bearer. So you try and save people's lives. But of course, you can imagine that was incredibly dangerous, going out into no man's land to sort of pull people back. So I think your life expectancy was not good with that job. So there were different levels of objection. But of course you were vilified.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah. So Hannah, the heroine, feels disloyal. She's not desperately in love with her own husband who's on the actual front.
Mm. Yeah, and that's interesting, because this is where I had to perhaps go off into my fictional world, because I know for a fact that the real Hannah, I know that when she married at 20... she was 7 months pregnant, because I know that from the birth certificates. Her daughter was born 2 months later. So writing the novel, I had to try and think about what was her relationship with her husband, and did she perhaps feel quite trapped into marrying him at a young age? And so that's how I decided the relationship was. Perhaps it wasn't the love of her life, but she was pregnant and she married him. They had another child about 6 months before the First World War started. And even though I feel she probably wasn't desperately in love with him, I felt she almost certainly wouldn't have wanted him to go, because she was then at home with two very young children, with a separation allowance from the army, which wasn't desperately generous, especially with prices rising all the time. And resentful, lonely, very poor. And she takes this job as a waitress in a cafe on the Isle of Dogs, and she meets Richard Luck. And I think she would have felt desperately guilty about the affair. My feeling from documents at the time is that she was quite a sort of, definitely of the respectable working classes, but she was confronted with this temptation.
And also the children in it are so well described. I suspect that you have children. Do you have children?
Yes, I do. I do have children.
Brilliant. I mean, just the descriptions of the runny noses and the complaining and the naughty daughter, and, you know, I thought, oh, she's got a kid.
Yeah. Well, I've got two daughters and a son, and they're now 10, 13 and 15. But it's strange, because actually I have a photograph of the real, well, she's Alice in the book. Her real name was Florrie. And in the photograph that I have of her, she's just a toddler sitting on her mum's knee, and she's got this cheeky glint in her eye. So I instantly thought, oh, she's a real cheeky toddler. Must be subconscious, but several people have read the book and said, oh, that's Izzy, who's my oldest daughter. Actually, it's a 15-year-old. It's really lovely and sensible, but a toddler was such a handful. And yeah. I think probably, without it meaning it, of course, elements of that have crept in, yeah.
And lastly, I want to ask, how attached are you to the characters in the book?
Very much attached. And I think also being in touch with the families has made me feel really quite responsible. Even though I fictionalised them, I feel a sympathy for them. At the time, they would have been ostracised because of what went on. And I don't necessarily say what they did was right. But I wanted to just try and explore why they felt trapped into making the decisions they made. Because life was just unimaginably different 100 years ago.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, Juliet West.
Thanks, Josephine.
And
thank you.
Before the Fall is by Juliet West and is published by Pam Macmillan. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
It's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you.
Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay. Singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited, then he shouted to them there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
It's a long way to Tipperary.
Irish Molly, oh, saying, should you not receive it, write and let me know. If I make mistakes in spelling, Molly dear, said he, remember it's the pen that's bad, don't lay the blame on me. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way.